You are listening to the podcast ICU Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center, Vanderbilt Regional Burn Center. The topic that I would like to discuss today is extremity compartment syndrome. Compartment syndromes occur whenever the pressure inside a particular anatomical area exceeds the pressure which allows adequate blood flow and subsequent delivery of oxygen and cellular nutrients. Left untreated, an extremity compartment syndrome will lead to the destruction of muscular tissue, resulting in myonecrosis or muscle death, and that will ultimately result in the release of myoglobin and subsequent renal failure. There are several things that can initiate this sequence of events, and this gets into the idea of a primary and secondary injury. A primary injury, we need to think a lot like when we think about people who've had a traumatic brain injury. In the case of traumatic brain injury, a primary injury can be somebody hitting somebody in the head with a baseball bat, a fall, or a gunshot wound. And that results in primary organ damage in the brain. What then follows is an inflammatory cascade that results in swelling of the brain. And it's that swelling of the brain that's frequently the most lethal component, or this what's called the secondary brain injury. We have something very similar to that when we're talking about extremity compartment syndromes, that the primary insult may be the result of a traumatic event, a fracture, a gunshot wound, a stab wound, or an ischemic event, such as an arterial injury. And the longer that limb is injured, or in the case of ischemia, is ischemic, then that reperfusion phenomena then results in cellular swelling. And that's the secondary injury, follows the primary injury, occurs as a result of swelling and upregulation of the inflammatory cascade, or typically cytokine release, and that results in that inflammatory response. Now, compartment syndrome of the extremity is different than what we see typically in burns, which require fasciotomy, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. Compartment syndromes may present clinically as a swelling or enlargement of the extremity, or it may not be as clinically apparent as one may think. If you imagine that the skin is acting as kind of a constricting element, and that the fascia, skin is in allowing tissues to swell deep to them, but the skin or the overlying fascia is restrictive, and therefore injured tissue begins to swell until it basically takes up that entire volume, and then as it swells, what it does is then it starts compressing vascular structures, vascular structures. Typically, the first thing that is obstructed is venous outflow because of the low pressure of the venous system, and as the venous outflow is obstructed, then you have essentially a venous tourniquet where you have arterial inflow. There are four key factors that determine the significance or the potential of damage with extremity compartment syndrome. And those four key factors are, number one, the rapidity of onset. The more rapid the onset, the more devastating that elevated pressure is going to be. Number two is the duration of the intracompartmental hypertension. And again, as you imagine it, the longer that the patient has elevated compartment pressures, the more damage that's going to be done to the muscular and nerve tissue due to decreased perfusion and oxygen delivery. The third element is the compartment perfusion pressure. And we're going to discuss this a little bit more in detail. The compartment perfusion pressure should be thought of much like the cerebral perfusion pressure that we think about in regards to the management of cerebral hypertension following traumatic brain injury. The fourth element is the rapidity of decompression. Basically, the longer you allow it to sit there, the more damage you're going to have. If you would identify the compartment syndrome more rapidly and decompress it more rapidly, the better your outcomes are going to be. Now, going back to the rapidity of onset, intracompartmental hypertension that develops gradually over time generally is better tolerated when it develops rather precipitously as a result of acute injury. Prolonged intracompartmental hypertension and inadequate compartment perfusion pressure uniformly leads to cellular hypoxia, progressive secondary injury, and permanent tissue damage. And we need to go back and really define what is this compartmental perfusion pressure. Typically, when we think of extremity compartment syndrome, we're thinking of compartment syndrome developing in the lower leg, and in some cases, we see it in the upper extremity. Where in burns, where we see compartment pressures, are people who've had very serious and very deep burns to either the upper extremities or the lower extremities. And what happens in people who require fasciotomies, now this is in contrast to people who need escharotomies, in fasciotomies, the muscles basically cook. And as they cook, they swell, and as they swell, they compress the veins and the arteries, and then therefore you've got an ischemic group of muscles. We see it also in electrical injuries, where somebody may have have grabbed a high tension line, and you've got a conduction of electrical current from arm to arm. And those patients will typically have forearm compartment syndromes, and can also have lower extremity compartment syndromes as well. The extremities possess a complex arrangement of relatively small fascial membrane enclosed compartments that contain vital muscles, nerve, and vascular structures. For instance, in the lower extremity, we have four fascial compartments, or four compartments that we measure pressures in and try to decompress. That's the anterior, the lateral, the posterior superficial, and the posterior deep. It's important to note that there is no medial compartment. A variety of injuries and illnesses encountered in the intensive care unit may increase intracompartmental pressures and potentially result in vascular insufficiency, peripheral nerve ischemia, and this is known as Volkmann's ischemic contracture, muscle necrosis, and even loss of the injured extremity. I don't want you to think that a compartment syndrome is solely an isolated injury to an extremity. It may also produce systemic manifestations from an extremity compartment syndrome, and these can include the development of acute respiratory distress syndrome, cardiac failure, renal failure, diffuse intravascular coagulation, and even multisystem organ failure, organ dysfunction. When one is working in an intensive care unit, one really should consider the possibility of a patient developing an extremity compartment syndrome in patients who have had prolonged vascular occlusion, typically greater than 6 hours after injury or before reconstruction is completed successfully. Now, this could be certainly in a traumatic case, but it could also be in a vascular patient who's thrown an occlusive embolus to the lower extremity and is delayed seeking medical care or definitive surgical care. People who have combined arterial and venous vascular injuries are certainly at risk. People who have long bone fractures, people who have marked traumatic soft tissue injury due to the edema, people who've had massive resuscitations, and we've seen this being reported more and more in trauma literature, people who initially have had these horrible abdominal compartment syndromes, and then now subsequent to that, we also learned that patients can also have extremity compartment syndromes from nothing else other than massive resuscitation with intravenous fluids. Those people who've had abdominal compartment syndromes or intra-abdominal hypertension for basically the same reasons, is that in the case of a massive surge response or a massive fluid resuscitation, the patient will get a surge-type response. Typically, they end up getting massive amounts of intravenous fluids, and abdominal compartment syndrome is from swelling or edema of the intra-abdominal viscera. If you can have swelling of your intra-abdominal viscera enough to impair return of blood flow through the vena cava and movement of the diaphragm, certainly you can have swelling of the musculature of the extremities enough that they can swell within their fascial compartments and result in extremity compartment syndromes. Anybody who has marked edema secondary to systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and anybody who has prolonged immobilization. I've seen several of those in my time. You've had patients who overdose on one thing or another, heroin, and they're at a party and they collapse in a closet and somebody finds them 2 days later and they've been immobilized on their leg or something, and they'll come in with a compartment syndrome and will often end up losing muscle, if not even a portion of the limb. Patients who've been have suffered from an envenomation from something like snake bites, compressive dressings and tourniquets, and this is a very important point to make, that I've seen one of these cases during my years in practice, and this was a patient who had a cast on that was too tight, and the patient was complaining of a lot of pain, and by the time the cast got split, the patient had developed a significant compartment syndrome and required muscle debridement of muscle from the anterior compartment of the leg. This is not only true of casts, but it's also true of people who've even had tight bandages. Burn patients typically are wrapped in tight ACE bandages, and you can actually put an ACE bandage on tight enough that you can actually create a compartment syndrome. So when anybody has a cast on, a splint, or any kind of dressing, they're complaining of pain in that extremity, you need to take that very seriously. In patients who've had extravasation of intravenous or contrast material, and we've seen this in infants, particularly in very small infants that are in a pediatric intensive care unit or neonatal intensive care unit, and there's been extravasation. In those very small kids, it doesn't really take much fluid to extravasate into the soft tissues that can basically impair venous drainage and arterial inflow of that extremity and result in a compartment syndrome. So, how do we make the diagnosis? Well, the diagnosis of extremity compartment syndrome typically refers to something called the classic six Ps, and we discuss this because it's classic. Pain, paresthesias, pressure, pallor, paralysis, and pulselessness. And those are presented in the frequency in which they occur. Pain being the most common, paresthesias being the second most common, pressure. But by the time you get to pallor, paralysis, and pulselessness, the compartment syndrome has likely to have been present for quite a long time. The other key thing to point out there is that pulselessness is typically the last thing to develop. Remember when we talked about the pathophysiology is that you've got some sort of primary injury, which then subsequently sets you up for an inflammatory cascade that results in a swelling of the tissue and the muscle. That then does what? Well, that as the tissue begins to swell, it then occludes venous outflow, creating kind of like a venous tourniquet effect, and then over hours, the muscles swell at a faster rate to the point where they actually occlude arterial inflow. So the time you get down to pulselessness, you're basically down at the bottom of the cascade of events, and we'd like to avoid that if we absolutely can. Now, unfortunately, these clinical signs and symptoms can be difficult to assess in a patient who is in the intensive care unit. They're critically ill. They may be intubated. They may be on drips of benzodiazepines or fentanyl. And they may have some rather bulky dressings on because they may have suffered a traumatic injury and it may have had an orthopedic fixation. Of the six Ps, pain is the most sensitive for predicting elevated intra-abdominal pressures. It's typically described as pain out of proportion to the physical findings, and the presence of such pain out of proportion should be considered evidence of an extremity compartment syndrome until proven otherwise. And typically, a patient who typically will present pain out of proportion to the uninitiated, which is really a nice way of saying to the naive provider, the inexperienced provider, somebody may just think somebody is drug-seeking or a little bit crazy because why on earth are they complaining of such incredible pain? Well, if you come across that individual, you have to not dismiss it as the patient being drug-seeking or poor behavior. You need to first say, does this patient actually have an organic reason for their pain and discomfort, and is that reason a compartment syndrome? The paresthesias are also a reasonably sensitive finding, but again, in an intensive care unit, that may be a rather subtle finding and may not be very difficult or may not be very easy to kind of tease out as to that complaint. Now, paralysis, as we said, is a late finding, and this is the result of prolonged nerve compression and or irreversible muscle damage and indicates that the diagnosis and appropriate intervention were delayed when you get to that point. And as we said, pulselessness is really the last sign to appear, and you really don't want to get to that point. If you're presenting a patient who has pulselessness and extremity compartment syndrome, to me that's kind of like the patient who you have the chest x-ray of the tension pneumothorax. You should never have an x-ray of a tension pneumothorax, and you should never have a patient who you rely on pulselessness to diagnose their compartment syndrome. Now, again, as we mentioned, that certainly in the intensive care unit, the diagnosis is certainly complicated by things like endotracheal tubes and sedation or concurrent traumatic brain injuries. So, therefore, you need to have a high index of suspicion for the development of an intracompartmental hypertension coupled with early measurement of compartmental pressures. And that really represents the most effective means of avoiding extremity compartment syndrome just basically by intervening early and having that high index of suspicion. People like to order things like serum creatinine phosphokinase and urinary myoglobin. They're really inappropriately performed because they really are markers of muscle ischemia. They're non-specific compartment syndrome, and insensitive as markers for early compartment pressure elevation. If you're having elevations of your CPK and urinary myoglobin, and you're using those as biomarkers for the development of a compartment syndrome, you've waited too long. I guess I would say that's like, you know, to determine whether somebody's house is on fire, if you see a dump truck hauling away, you know, loads of burnt timbers and saying, well, obviously there must be a house fire. Well, it's kind of late by then. You want something that you can actually intervene and actually save some tissue and do something about. But if you've got elevated CPKs and urinary myoglobin, for all intents and purposes, the horse is already out of the barn. Now, for the sake of discussion here, we're going to talk about compartment pressures of the lower extremity, because typically that's what most people will see. As I've mentioned, people who have electrical injuries will often have compartment syndromes of the upper extremity. But there are four compartments of each lower leg. There's the anterior, the lateral, the posterior superficial, and the posterior deep. And these are not, in the case of a compartment syndrome, the pressures in each of these compartments do not elevate uniformly during the injury. And therefore, it's important that you measure the compartment pressures of not a singular compartment, but all the compartments in an extremity, because you will miss if you take a pressure measurement and they say superficial posterior and it's normal. That does not necessarily mean that you do not have a compartment elevation in the anterior compartment. Compartment pressures of less than 20 millimeters of mercury are generally considered acceptable, but still warrant continued close observation in the patient who's considered at risk. If you have a patient whose pressures are at or above 30 millimeters of mercury, this really mandates immediate surgical evacuation and decompression. Where you get into kind of the gray zone are the patients who are in that between 20 and 30 millimeters of mercury. And the care of these patients have to be individualized based on the patient's overall condition as well as their clinical evaluation. We talked earlier about comparing compartment pressures for compartment syndrome of the extremities, similar to the way we would manage a patient who has increased intracranial hypertension from a traumatic brain injury. And we understand that when we look at somebody who's got an increased ICP or intracranial pressure, that we have to look at what is the perfusion of the blood to the brain, and that's really defined as the cerebral perfusion pressure. And the cerebral perfusion pressure, when we talk about brain injury, is really defined as what the mean arterial pressure is minus the cerebral perfusion, minus the intracranial pressure. So mean arterial pressure minus intracranial pressure, and that gives you cerebral perfusion pressure, basically the pressure at which blood is perfusing through the brain. Elevated compartment pressures need to be think of something very similar to that, and that's the extremity perfusion pressure. Now, the extremity perfusion pressure, if you have a patient who has, say, a measured pressure of, say, 22 or 25, they're in that gray zone. Well, what if the patient is hypotensive? What if their mean pressures are sitting down in the 60s, and you're sitting there with a compartment pressure of, say, 25, then what is your extremity perfusion pressure, and that would be defined as your mean arterial pressure minus the greatest intracompartmental pressure. In this case, it would be 25. Elevated compartment pressures in a normal tensive or hypertensive patient are less likely to cause ischemia than elevated compartment pressures in the hypotensive patient. As a result, maintenance of an extremity perfusion pressure of at least 30 to 40 millimeters of mercury is strived for. So if you looked at our patient who we said had a mean pressure of 65 but had an elevated intracompartmental pressure of 25, then that would leave you with a extremity perfusion pressure of 35. Now, the treatment for extremity compartment syndrome is immediate decompressive fasciotomy of all the musculofascial compartments. Rapid diagnosis and expeditious decompression is essential because of the duration and severity of the elevated intracompartmental pressure directly correlates with the likelihood of muscle damage and nerve damage. Decompression may be formed either in the operating room or, which is really more practical than what we do, typically in the intensive care unit. Patients with documented myoglobinuria require generous hydration if possible and alkalinization. And remember, that's a relative alkalinization. Actually, you don't need to alkalinize the urine to a pH of greater than 7, which is very difficult, but you have to remember what the pKa of myoglobin is. When you're trying to alkalinize the urine, you're trying to make that myoglobin molecule more soluble so it doesn't precipitate in the renal tubules and result in renal failure. We've actually described that in reasonably good detail in the podcast on crush injuries. The other thing is that the podcast on crush injuries actually goes through a lot of the complications of myonecrosis. And with the recent earthquakes in China, we did that podcast after a earthquake in South America. And it's very important information if there's any likelihood that you'll be carrying for people who may be involved in a building collapse. Bicarbonate is another consideration that people will do to try to increase the urine output and make myoglobin more soluble because it is a large protein. If left untreated, the myoglobinuria from the compartment syndrome can actually result in renal failure, which would require hemodialysis. It's time for me to take a brief time out. Now I want to turn our discussion not so much to compartment syndrome, but focus a little bit more on the burn patient. We know that patients who have circumferential injuries to their extremities and burn patients can have pathophysiology very like the patient who is suffering from a compartment syndrome. In the patient who is suffering the compartment syndrome, the muscles are expanding in the fixed volume of the surrounding muscle fascia. And what's causing that muscle swelling could be burn injury, it could be trauma, it could be ischemia, it could be immobility. In burn situation, what's happening is that with a third degree burn or full thickness burn, the surrounding skin envelope basically turns to leather and it shrinks, decreasing its surface area, contracts. At the same time, the injured soft tissues, being subcutaneous fat, and in the case of very deep muscles, even the muscle inside the fascia are expanding in that fixed envelope or that decreasing envelope of skin. And the same pathophysiology sets up is that as the subcutaneous tissues begin to swell, they initially occlude the small veins and the larger veins. That results in arterial inflow with decreased venous outflow, and that results in a more rapid progression of the swelling to the point where you will get occlusion of arterial inflow. The treatment for this is escharotomies. And an escharotomy is basically making an incision in the burn eschar. I remember when I was a traveling burn fellow, I spent some time at the burn unit in Manhattan at the New York Hospital Cornell. And I remember one of the faculty giving one of the residents a hard time because they made an incision and extended beyond the burn eschar. And he says, you cannot make an escharotomy where there is no eschar. And I've seen that done numerous times. You make the incision strictly through the burn eschar. And when you make that incision, what happens is it's much like opening kind of like those Pillsbury biscuits you can buy in the supermarket. When you open a can of Pillsbury biscuits, they're under pressure. And you hear that almost a rushing sound. And as the can of biscuits decompresses, you get this push sound. And somebody who really needs escharotomies, you get something very similar to that. As soon as you go through that burn eschar, the pressure of the underlying subcutaneous tissues basically pops and decompresses the extremity. Now, escharotomies are classically described in making them in a medial and lateral incision. It's important that, particularly in the arms, and patients who are lying there, typically their palms are pronated down. And if you make what appears to be a medial incision, you'll go right through the antecubital fossa. And if you go lateral, you're going to go right over the olecranon. So it's important that you hold or have an assistant hold that upper extremity in a true anatomical position. And a true anatomical position is where the thumb is pointing straight lateral and the palm is forward, and make the incisions true medial and true lateral. Similar type of things in the leg. You want to make sure that you make that you're just not making an incision into the burn, but you're making the incision deep enough that you're actually decompressing swollen tissue. Inexperienced provider will often make some of these escharotomies extraordinarily deep and down in the muscle. It is not a fasciotomy. Fasciotomy is deeper, it's down in the muscle fascia. Not everybody who needs escharotomies needs fasciotomies, but there are a subset of patients who have very deep burns of their extremities, and they do require fasciotomies, or patients who have had electrical injuries. We don't recommend you take fasciotomies, excuse me, escharotomies lightly just because somebody has a burn at circumferential and it's perhaps superficial partial thickness, or the burn is soft, that person immediately get an escharotomy. You can watch those patients in your intensive care unit, and if there's any signs of vascular compromise, then proceed with the escharotomy. But leaving escharotomies does complicate the wound closure of the patients, leaves some deformity there, and it's obvious to patients not only after you graft the patient, but even years later. Some have actually have taken strips of Integra, which is a dermal matrix, and basically resurfaced the area of the escharotomy with the Integra prior to autografting, so you don't get that contour deformity. Now, when thinking about escharotomies of the trunk, contracting burn eschar may not result in a potentially limb-threatening injury in that case, but it could be a potentially life-threatening condition, because if you have a circumferential burn around the trunk, or rather significant anterior chest wall burns, what that does is that decreases the compliance of the chest wall. It can make it very difficult to ventilate, if not impossible, to ventilate a patient. Or a patient may have elevated peak inspiratory pressures. Keep in mind that what makes up peak inspiratory pressure, or the formula for peak inspiratory pressure, is the tidal volume over the compliance of the lung and thorax plus the product of the resistance of the airway and the flow of the gas. So things that will decrease the compliance of your chest wall, namely having thick burn eschars, will result in a decrease in compliance and an elevation of your peak inspiratory pressure at the same tidal volume. So a patient during transport may see a rather significant, if you have somebody on a volume limited mode of ventilation, say a tidal volume set at 500 or 600 throughout transport, you may see an increase in the peak inspiratory pressure. And the reason why is that eschar is contracting the chest wall as it sets up and the patient's getting volume resuscitated. There's a decrease in their thoracic compliance resulting in that elevation of your peak inspiratory pressure. If a patient is on pressure-limited or pressure-control modes of ventilation, you'll see a decrease in your tidal volume based on the same physiology. The treatment there is to do an escharotomy of the chest wall. I'm not a big believer that escharotomies of the limbs need to be done in a pre-hospital or pre-burn center environment by people who have never done an escharotomy, because you do have some time in that circumstance. But patients sometimes are being transported long distances and they do experience respiratory embarrassment in an aircraft. And in those circumstances, the crews of the aircraft will typically contact us and ask for permission to proceed with an escharotomy. You should not take something like that lightly, because you are doing a minor surgical procedure in an austere condition. You may actually cause bleeding, which you will have to deal with. And in those circumstances, you typically want to make an incision in the anterior axillary line. We make a incision also down the mid-sternal area, and kind of a subcostal incision along the bottom of the thorax. Typically, when it comes to the superior portion of the thorax, we actually kind of make almost like a roof-type appearance with a sternal notch and then angulating downward as we move our incision medial to lateral. The idea there is we'd like to stay away from the subclavian areas, because those areas, typically if they're not burned, we don't want a wound there to complicate the placement and dressings of central venous catheters. If there are burns there, we would typically excise and graft those areas early and give us what we call lifeline portals, or what we call them here. It's because those are areas of high priority to get grafted, because a patient will eventually need lines. And if they're burned all over their chest, it means we're relegated to using lines in the groin, which are notoriously complicated for the development of infections and deep venous thrombosis. You've been listening to the podcast IC Rounds. My name is Jeff Guy, and this has been a discussion on extremity compartment syndrome. You can look at our other podcasts that are downloadable on iTunes. The key search there is IC Rounds, or you could visit the home website at www.icrounds.com. My name is Jeff Guy. Bye-bye.